Check, check, check.
Check.
Sound
Check,
is
check,
here.
Check.
All right. 3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Failure Piece Theater. I am your amiable co-host, Tim, and joining me as always is...
Catherine.
And we've returned from an abandoned apartment building in downtown Los Angeles at a nebulous time in the past to talk about a film directed by a guy who shot a film in an apartment complex in rundown Los Angeles at a nebulous point in the past. And that is the director Lee Cronin, who gained a lot of attention just a few months ago for his newest entry into the Evil Dead franchise, Evil Dead Rise. Lee Cronin is an Irish director, and the film that ostensibly got him that job is the one we're going to talk about today. And that is The Hole in the Ground, a 2019 independently produced, or mostly independently produced, Irish film written and directed by Cronin himself. Before we get into Hole in the Ground, let's talk a little bit about Evil Dead, because this is how, you know, I didn't know who Lee Cronin was before Evil Dead. I'll admit it. It sounds like I should have, because Hole in the Ground did get a lot of attention. It was the distribution rights were obtained by A24, so they distributed it in the United States, but they had nothing to do, from what I can tell, with any of its production. They put up no production money. They just agreed to distribute it here in the U.S. So it does have some A24 stank on it, if you want to call it that.
It's a good stank.
It's a good stank to have, you know, kind of gives you, it immediately bumps you into that elevated horror
just
genre.
The stank of profit.
Someone gave us this this legitimacy of A24 logo on the front end. But really, Evil Dead Rise is where I became aware of Cronin.
I do everything backwards and in a very roundabout way. I had a copy of The Hole in the Ground way before Evil Dead Rise was a thing, because I was trolling the Wikipedia article category for Finnish horror films, and this was in part funded by the Finnish Film Foundation.
Correct.
So it was listed, even though it's an Irish film, whatever, you know, movies, they're complicated.
I don't know the full production team on Hole in the Ground. I know Lee Cronin had a co-writer, Stephen Shields, who doesn't appear to have done much else, but this has a fairly prominent Finnish actress in it. Yes.
Yes. She, she plays a creepy old lady in nearly everything, including this. I get the connections. But that's how I found out about The Hole in the Ground. But I hadn't watched it. I just had a copy of it, and I was like, I'll watch this.
We'll get to this
someday.
Eventually.
I'll get to it. I have a lot of movies just sitting around that I keep saying I'll watch, and eventually I will. But what prompted me to finally watch this movie was Evil Dead Rise. Because I saw the director's name, and I was like, yeah, that looks familiar. Where have I heard them? I wonder if I know this guy. And then I circled back around to realize that I have his other movie just here.
Just sitting there.
just here, like, on the backlog. Like, I should watch this. Hole in the Ground, that sounds cool.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you feel about Evil Dead Rise?
Evil Dead Rise was very fine. Sort of aggressively fine. I think I definitely liked it more than Evil Dead 2013. Mm. 'Cause Evil Dead 2013 is mean.
Yeah, and gross.
It's a mean film, what it does to its characters. And I understand this is horror, right? Like, that's what happens. You know, characters have terrible things happen to them. But it felt more aggressive.
It was kind of joyless.
What most of the other, yes, very joyless. Like, there's no humor in that film whatsoever, which I understand what it feels like. And again, this could just be my read. It feels like they're trying to relaunch Evil Dead as Evil Dead 1, right? The one that was made to be a pure horror film, but then became a camp horror classic because it's just a bunch of dudes in a cabin in Kentucky.
It was unintentionally funny, and then it became intentionally funny.
And then in Evil Dead 2, they leaned into it. And for me, as I think I don't want to speak for all Evil Dead fans, because obviously that's a big range. But for me, the reason why Evil Dead is a thing is because of the balance of horror and comedy in Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, what we might call slapstick horror in Evil Dead 2 is what makes that film work. And I understand that there is a very specific recipe going on there that includes Bruce Campbell and his sort of gorgeous but malleable face. Like, there's a lot of things working in Evil Dead 2 that you can't really replicate easily. And if you tried too hard, it would be unwatchable.
Yeah.
So I get that. But it seems like they're trying to take Evil Dead now, you know, since 2013, and I would think Rise as well, into a very sort of pure horror franchise, right? That's what they're looking like, a sort of gory splatterhouse, pure horror thing. And while I still enjoy that, and I have a taste for those kinds of horror films, I think that there's not enough differentiation there, because you can see that in literally dozens and dozens of other films released consistently. And you know, Evil Dead does have an interesting lore, which Rise kind of leans into a little bit more and tries to establish, you know, some new rules. You know, very famously, Rise doesn't take place in the woods. It's in a city, which, you know, we really haven't seen before. It's always been, you know, the dark cabin in the woods story. So that's cool. I mean, you know, it was fine. I that's all I can really say. I didn't love it. I didn't leave it being like, wow, that was incredible. I mean, the ending of it is so over the top.
Yeah.
That I did find myself giggling quite a bit, like, oh God, you know, it's like, Jesus, you know, so it had kind of that effect. And I feel like some of that was definitely intentional. But yeah, it just didn't have the Evil Dead vibe that I was hoping it would have. And I know that's a very nebulous thing to say. It lacks specificity. But that's because I think what makes Evil Dead special is also kind of nebulous and difficult to ascertain. Some of it comes down almost completely to Sam Raimi's idiosyncrasies, like just the shit that he thinks is funny and interesting to do. So I don't know. The one thing, though, that I will say that was undeniable is that it looked incredible.
I would agree with that.
Evil Dead Rise. I think Jay on Red Letter Media said that he thought it was, he's like, this could just be somebody's film reel. Like, this looks like somebody trying to make a reel to show what they're best capable of. But the whole movie looks like that. And I kind of agree. Like, Cronin is swinging for the fences in Evil Dead Rise. The makeup effects are stellar. The lighting is incredible. It's essentially a bottle film. Like, 90% of it takes place in a 4 or 5 room apartment. And it's exceptionally well shot. It never gets boring. I mean, it's a director working within restrictions that show off just how capable that they are.
Yeah. I think, here's the thing. I think I would have loved Evil Dead Rise if it had just been called something else.
Sure. And I guess that's kind of my point. Because, like you
said, it's very nebulous what I want out of an Evil Dead movie, but this isn't quite it. I don't know what I want, but this wasn't it.
Again, I feel like we exist in the era of the franchise. Nobody just makes a movie anymore. They try to make a franchise. And if it's the first one, I mean, Evil Dead is already a franchise, so they're even sort of doubly screwed, because they're trying to restart a franchise, or at least kick off a new, you know, branching path of that franchise. And so, like, this movie feels like we're planting seeds to do more of this. And I just really think the better approach at this particular juncture would be to just focus on making a good one of these. Because, like, we've seen it happen dozens of times, right? I mean, I guess Friday the 13th series would be the most sort of famous example of, like, we made a pretty good one of these movies on purpose. Like, we knew what we were doing. We knew exactly the thing we were trying to execute on. And then it blew up and we needed to make another one. And so we just kind of retrofitted everything to fit, to be like, oh, well, now this is the bad guy, right? Like, they just changed everything to make it work. So I'm like, focus on making a great movie that you feel confident expresses the values of what Evil Dead is. And then worry about the franchise shit and having sequelitis later, you know, like just don't worry about it. You can figure that stuff out in the intervening years between the films, right? Like I just, you know, I don't agree with sort of planting all the hooks in advance, hoping that things will go well. By all accounts, Evil Dead Rise was a pretty significant success. So we're probably going to get more. Bruce Campbell, who's now listed as a producer on the Evil Dead franchise, has been for a long time, but now he is officially just one of the executives producing the series. I said they want to get to the point that it's an every 2 or 3 year kind of thing.
And which, I guess...
Sure.
Yeah. I'm fine with that because I think at the end of it, I want to look at these as a great launch pad for horror directors. Like Lee Krumman.
Sure. Yeah, and yeah. Definitely.
I don't think anybody would go back and see Hole in the Ground if Evil Dead Rise didn't have him behind it, which is really good because I actually think the Hole in the Ground is a better movie all around.
In some ways, yeah, for sure.
And I hope that he makes more, you know, non-franchise efforts, and maybe, you know, the attention that he gets from this project would help him do that. So if that's what Evil Dead is, then that's fine. Because I'm not so precious about Evil Dead 2 that I don't think they can make other movies. I don't know. I'm kind of over that part of my life. It's like, go ahead and make more. It doesn't change how I feel about Evil Dead 2.
Yeah, no, I definitely feel the same. Yeah, I don't want to be like, oh, this is my Evil Dead. It's like, no, it's Evil Dead, and it's very good. I mean, the demons in it are Evil Dead demons. Like, all of the pieces are there, and they're very satisfying to both a fan of the franchise and I think somebody just coming in who just enjoys horror films, right? Because there are going to be a lot of people that walked into Evil Dead Rise who maybe knew of Evil Dead as a franchise, but I mean, we haven't had one of those movies since 2013. That's a whole generation or half a generation of potential horror fans who may not have any context for what Evil Dead is. And I understand you need to hook that group too. And if you're just trying to grab that sort of generic stereotypical horror fan, Evil Dead Rise will probably do that because it's pretty fantastic. You know, so yeah, I don't want to get into this, like, you know, I'm a fan of Evil Dead and I don't think there's a very good, like, no, it's a great movie. I don't think it's an exceptionally good Evil Dead movie myself. I think it's very, again, it's aggressively fine. Like it's very good, but I, you know, Evil Dead and most horror movies, you know, you think about the kills and sort of like how people go down, and there's certainly some good ones in there, but a lot of them aren't really good. I think my biggest thing with it, and I think this is true of all horror movies that where you're fighting a supernatural force, is that your win conditions become very limited. And so like about 30 minutes into this movie, once I realized that they were establishing, because one of the big things that this one establishes a bit more clearly than previous Evil Deads is how the evil can spread, right? Like, once it's loose, it's not going to be contained in a single individual, right? Which is kind of what we had seen in previous Evil Deads. And so once they established that as a feature, that these things can just kind of spread, you know, either by, and again, this was not especially, is it like through touch? Is it through?
Like fluids.
Getting like vomited on, which is a lot of vomiting.
There's a lot of black vomiting.
You know, like, And again, that's just not something we'd necessarily seen before. And once I realized that that's what was happening, though, I was like, well, what can you do against that? Like, how can you stop that? And ultimately, it kind of, you kind of can't. And so, like, well, that sucks, right? Like, you know, because that's one thing that Evil Dead did have. You know, Ash doesn't necessarily defeat the evil, but he kind of does in the moment, at the least, you know, and so that was an element that I was a little bummed by, but yeah, so you know, we talk about Evil Dead Rise, and you know, one, because we probably can't talk about it on this podcast necessarily because it was a huge success by all measures. It reviewed very well. It got like 80% ish or so on Rotten Tomatoes, which is pretty uncommon for a gory horror film under normal circumstances. And it made significant box office, probably more than enough to satisfy needs for justifying a sequel. But we talk about that so that we can walk it back and talk about Cronin's previous effort, where Evil Dead Rise is big and extreme and over the top. Hole in the Ground is quiet and subtle and extremely capably sort of handled. Cronin, I mean, after watching Hole in the Ground, if I was a producer in Hollywood who was looking for somebody to helm a horror project, I would call Cronin for sure. Like, this guy would very, very quickly ratchet to the top of my short list of people to get a hold of and say, hey, would you be interested in an Evil Dead movie? Is that a thing you'd want to do, man?
You're and, a movie guy.
Do you like movies? Hollywood? It was pretty good. So Holding the Ground came out, as we said, in 2019. It did have a world premiere at Sundance, where, from what I can tell, it did not sell. At least not to distribution immediately. Again, A24 wound up with it, but I don't know if that acquisition took place at Sundance. It may have. I mean, it looks like they did get a UK distributor out of the Sundance premiere, but I think the American one might have come later. So it didn't make any huge ripples at Sundance in 2019, but Sundance is not the film festival it once was, if we're being honest.
I don't think any film festival is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say they're all compromised. That's not true, really. But most of these major things are basically programmed by the studios now. They're not really as independent as they once were. Independent films do sneak in, but are we ever going to see a Clerks at Sundance again?
God, I hope not. Oh, I'm sorry.
More in terms of the phenomenon of a guy bringing a $20,000 movie to a film festival and selling it for, you know, quarter mil or whatever. Are we going to see that again? I don't know. But regardless,
what's going to happen is that dude puts his movie on YouTube now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you don't really need Sundance to bring that film to an audience. You could certainly benefit from it and the potential of it. But yeah, you can put that movie in lots of other places. Tubi, for example. I mean, Tubi's just right there. Well, I mean, just take it to Tubi.
God obviously. Bless Tubi.
A Tubi exclusive. But so Hole in the Ground is I mean, I would call it a quiet film. Like, it certainly has some pretty big moments in it, but it is this sort of quiet story. It is set in Ireland, which is where Cronin is from. And it is about a mother and her young son who have recently moved to a small town in the Irish countryside, seemingly under some pretty negative circumstances that sort of get revealed over the course of the film. And both their struggles to adapt to the new environment, but also after an incident where they nearly hit a woman in the road, the aforementioned actress that you were speaking of. The creepy old lady actress from the great land of Finland.
What's her name? Is it Oitinen?
Yeah, like, it's Oitinen. Yeah.
I'm not good with pronouncing Finnish names. You would think I would be, because my boyfriend's from there. But
I'm sure he could come in and correct you. He's going to burst through the door Ted Lasso style and be like,
hear me.
It's Whedon. God.
Because he said it right away, you know. But then sure. I forgot how he said it. Because
Finnish is hard.
It's hard.
All those verb variations.
So many vowels.
So many vowels.
The word should not have that many vowels.
But in essence, her son disappears in the middle of the night for a short period of time and then doesn't seem to be himself afterwards. It's an excellently written story. It's unspooled very well. We do have a wonderful cameo turn from James Cosmo, who is certainly another guy who probably falls into that. Yeah, I know that guy from that thing.
Duncan McLeod.
Kind of guy.
He was Angus MacLeod, wasn't he?
He was Angus MacLeod in Highlander. Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeedy. He also, I mean, I saw him recently, that Jack Ryan show on Amazon, the third season of that. He played, of all things, he's a Scottish actor, but he played a Russian KGB agent, an aging KGB agent, and was very good in that. But again, if you watch this film, you'll see him and be like, yeah, I know that guy. But yeah, so you know, Cronin, we're being drawn to him from Evil Dead Rise, right? We're being drawn to him because that film is visually impressive and very capably directed. So in watching this, you know, again, it's weird to kind of backport it because Evil Dead Rise is this very specific kind of film. And then, you know, this is like all shots of, you know, beautiful Irish countryside, small country houses. It's this quiet sort of familial drama at the same time. But I was equally impressed with how good this film looks. This is a great looking movie.
This like vibes with me the same way that the Babadook vibe with me.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned the Babadook. I had the Babadook in my notes. I did indeed.
It's got that creepy little kid drama. But, you know, there's a twist on it. But the familial part of it, and it's a mother and son story. Right. Yeah, that's what it reminded me of. And the Babadook was such a beautiful looking film. And this is kind of similarly a beautiful looking film.
Yeah, Jennifer Kent. I mean, obviously, Jennifer Kent. Did you ever see The Nightingale, her follow-up to The Babadook?
I don't think so.
The visual look of this, just sort of the natural tones, everything's a bit muted. There was some similarities there. Like Nightingale is a very different film from The Babadook. It is still a horrific film, but it is not like a supernatural horror film. It's a historical drama about a very specific time in New Zealand's history, but brutal, especially in terms of the way that it portrays the treatment of women at this time, the abuse that they often suffered at the hands of sometimes, you know, their husbands, sometimes, you know, men who claimed them and there was little they could do to stop them. It's a difficult film to watch, but it's extremely good. But yes, this had Babadook vibes for me again, not because there's going to be like a giant scary, you know, weird faced monster that comes in the back half, but mostly because it is that sort of quiet, grief ridden exploration of a family in trauma.
Yeah. Right?
And that to me is as difficult as the coordination of something like Evil Dead Rise is, right? Getting all of those pieces to function together, from the effects work to the actors, you know, which is another thing I'll say, the kid actors in Evil Dead Rise are all great. And the kid actor in this is pretty good. Maybe Cronin took what he learned from working with this kid actor and was like, oh, we're not doing that again. We're going to get some good kids for this shit.
Yeah, I mean, this kid in this movie, I don't like the child, but I think that's was the point. I am not supposed to like this kid, even because what ends up happening is that the way he is in the beginning of the film, you hate him, but then you end up wishing that he were still like that, which is sort of an interesting effect. Like, I hated that kid, but I want that kid back.
Right, because that's the actual kid.
Yeah.
Right? Which is where the story goes. So I appreciated this because, you know, my original training was in psychology. And one of the, you know, when you're taking an abnormal psych class, one of the things that your abnormal psychology instructors really love to do is trot out the weird shit, right? Because here's the thing, kids. The human brain is an incredibly complex electrochemical machine. And there are millions of failure points inside of that electrochemical machine. And sometimes those failure points are so destructive to the normal functioning of that human brain that we can barely explain what it is, let alone why it happens. And One of those is a condition identified by a French psychologist named after him, called Capgras syndrome. And Capgras syndrome can occur in a variety of circumstances. Typically, the way it's often portrayed is that it's post a brain injury of some kind. Although it can happen seemingly naturally or because of semi-natural causes, some kind of degradation in the brain, a subfunction of dementia, etc. But Capgras syndrome at its core is when a human being, for reasons unknown, looks at another individual, typically a close family member, and believes, without cause or explanation, that that person is an imposter. That they are not the person that they claim to be, and instead they have been supplanted by someone who is not that person. This belief is, when it takes hold, is unshakable. Right? There is no convincing that you can do to help this person recontextualize who this other individual is. Like, no, that's Johnny. That's your brother. Of course it's Johnny. Who else could it be? Because of this syndrome, they no longer believe that it's Johnny. And that at its core is sort of what's happening in this film, or at least that's what's being explored. I don't know if anybody ever uses the phrase Capgras syndrome in the film, which is not necessary. Like, again, I don't like it when movies feel the need to, you know, have two characters sit down over coffee and be like, you know,
that psychologist scene that comes at the end when
you got a Bagul problem, right? Don't want Vincent D'Onofrio having to zoom in to explain everything. And I'm fine with that. But as a person who was familiar with that condition, and has read a few different stories, you know, sort of case studies of individuals who suffered from it, I immediately noted that that was also being set up as a potential explanation for what's happening, because she doesn't start to hold this belief. It comes post the car accident, where she does inflict a fairly severe injury to her head. It's also implied that she had sustained head injury as a part of her relationship. The mother and the son have fled to the Irish countryside, we come to find out, because of, and I guess we're in spoiler territory now, pause here if you want to go watch the film, and not be sort of spoiled about what's going on. But she was being abused by her partner.
Yeah. And you're sort of wondering if maybe she fled, because they did move like to the middle of nowhere
very quickly.
But I actually like that none of that is necessarily explained. Like, they don't go into this huge backstory about her abusive relationship, because it's just not necessary. Mm-mm. You get all
it's
of the right
the
hints.
Yeah, it's very cool. I guess before, you know, I guess we've spoiled a couple of things, although I don't think those are spoilers. They're really just confirmations of things that I suspected almost immediately, that this was kind of what was going on. And it's more just the film sort of confirming, yes, this is what's going on. But this is a big recommend from me, like straight out of the gate. Like, if you haven't watched this, it's on HBO Max right now streaming, or Max, excuse me. They've just rebranded. It's not HBO Max anymore. Why would you want to associate yourself with such a terrible brand, a brand that everyone hates? You know, instead you just call it Max and you dump all your Discovery Channel bullshit on it. Fantastic. But anyway, it is streaming there, so you can get a hold of it fairly easily.
Where is it streaming?
That on Max.
Oh, okay.
Yes, not HBO Max, just Max. It's where you go for all your entertainment. It's the maximum amount of entertainment, I'm led to believe. Because what I wanted was to be able to see a card for The Last of Us, you know, a great television show, right next to a card for Dr. Pimple Popper. That's what I was really looking for in my video streaming experience. And then right after that, we've got Chet and Joanna Gaines out here making some Magnolia properties look great and selling them for dozens of dollars more than they paid, and whatever. Like, all that shit is now on the same app, and it's just so exciting. moving on. So it is there, but this is a big recommend. I would say definitely check this film out if you don't want to be spoiled on it at all further, because we are going to get into the remainder of the twists and turns. I would say pause and go check it out because it's good. How about you?
Yes, I really, really enjoyed this. Big recommend. I like a creepy kid horror movie. There's no shortage of those. I know that creepy little children are kind of a mainstay of horror, but I always have a good time when they're creepy little kids.
Yep. You want to hate children when you see them on screen.
And I do.
That's what you want. And man, there you go. It's like that Hereditary girl. You know, you looked at her and you went like,
"You have a nut allergy, stupid." Yeah. Why would you eat that cake?
Don't eat the cake. Dumb idiot.
You could see that there were almonds on it. Don't give me that shit. Well, I mean, she can't argue now.
No. There's her some things that happen in that over. Film that prevent the ability for her to argue the point. But anyway, so yeah, let's get into it. So they've moved to the Irish countryside. The mom is obviously beleaguered and wearied. She's played here by, and again, Irish pronunciations of Irish names. Saoirse Ronan, like, that's not what her name looks like. That's not.
Is it Shauna?
But I'm guessing it's either Shauna or Shayna. Yes. Shauna Kerslake or Kerslake. Who, had done some acting before, but she's very good in this. She's obviously at a very difficult point in her life. She's just trying to hold things together. There is a nice visual metaphor in this of her like re-wallpapering the stairway. You know, that's supposed to be like her. I think it's meant to be sort of a visual representation of her sort of gaining some measure of confidence back kind of thing. Although I did note that the pattern on the wallpaper was very shining. Like it wasn't an exact copy, because that's just too obvious at this point. Everybody's fucking done that. You know, oh, look. Yeah, like this is a, hey, you know.
And like I did.
Shining
I saw
up
it.
Here in Ireland. I did.
And I saw what you did there.
And so the film opens, you know, she's just getting her son from school. The son has lots of questions about when is dad coming, you know? So again, all of these ideas about like, you know, oh, maybe she's run from an abusive relationship. All this stuff kind of comes to the forefront very quickly. And then she has an actual confrontation with the son. The son gets angry at her about the situation and she doesn't really know how to handle it. And then, you know, things kind of escalate from there. They're driving home. She narrowly misses Kati Owinen.
Just call her the creepy Finnish lady.
The creepy Finnish lady. She's standing in the middle of the road looking very creepy. The way that she's lit, she looks almost demonic, right? Her face is pale and wrinkled, and she's wearing this dark hood.
The actual actress is beautiful. Like, she's a beautiful woman.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Every single movie, they just make her look really harrowing and scary.
Hey, man. If you can corner the market on a character like that, you'll always have work. And at the end of the day, that's what you're going for, right? But so they narrowly miss her. She crashes the car and hits her head. And they find out that this is a relatively famous local woman who many years ago had, I guess, killed her own son with their car.
Yeah, there's kind of like a question whether she killed him or whether it was an accident. Some people say it's an accident, but some people are like, well, an accident. Shauna Kerslake gets this information secondhand from somebody that the mother started accusing her son of not being her son.
Right.
It's not him. And then he gets hit by a car and she's driving the car. So was it an accident? Probably not.
Who knows, right? And as a result, they've been kind of, she also meets briefly her husband and he apologizes, says, you know, she wanders sometimes. And you know, a relationship kind of gets forged there because they obviously live in the same general area, which is also important. So things progress relatively quickly. The son continues to be kind of distant from the mother. He doesn't like the food she makes. He sort of refuses to eat. You know,
it's funny. He's an annoying kid, but I really liked that he had sort of a distinct personality, and that ends up being really important.
That's important.
But extremely, in so yeah. many of these movies, whether it's a creepy little kid or a kid in distress, they always kind of forget to make them people.
Right. And give they them, don't like, have interests. Wants and wishes.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all like, just little Brady kid zombies. Yeah, that just kind of do whatever they're told.
That, yeah, right. They follow their parents around, and it's so you can focus on the drama of the parents. But in this one, this kid has a real personality. And he's disagreeable, and he's moody.
Totally.
And I don't know, he felt like a very real child, which I liked. I didn't like him. I don't like little kids, but I really liked that.
And I think that's where the Babadook stuff started to come in, because that's one thing that Jennifer Kent captured so well in the Babadook, is that kids in trauma are not good kids, right? Like,
no,
like they are good kids, but they feel pain and they express rage and they cry and they scream, and that's real and that's normal, right? And this kid is doing the same thing. And yeah, that kid in the Babadook had the same problems because he was also experiencing grief and pain, and the mom was not helping him through it. And this mom seems well-meaning enough, right? Like, she's trying, but she herself is so sort of distraught and disoriented. And we get a lot of backstory a little bit later. She goes to she started working at a, like an antique shop. Right. She's like a clerk at an antique shop to make money. And she's become friends with the owner, and she gets invited out for dinner or something. And it comes to light that, you know, she had been in school. She had been, going to college, which, you know, she was trying to carve out a life for herself, and then seemingly got pregnant with this partner. And then all of that kind of fell apart. And again, I really like the subtlety of this script, because this is where you go and you have the emotional scene with the mom where she's like, and that's when Tony started beating me. And that's when he wouldn't let me leave the house anymore. And that's when he, you know, like that's the scene typically where all of that breaks down and none of that happens.
Yeah.
Right. It's just we decided that, you know, maybe I shouldn't go to school anymore. And, you know, pretty familiar with the mechanics of abuse, how that works. And that's abuse. And that's how abuse actually rears its head, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody breaks down. Nobody cries after a certain point. Yeah, you're not going to do that in front of people. You're not going to have a conversation about it. And I like that it's handled that way here. It's very much all hints and subtlety and, nah, everything's fine. Nah, we're good. You know, no problem. And it just kind of gets glossed over and shifted, and everybody gets uncomfortable and they stop talking about it, because that's what fucking happens. And this just, it felt very natural. There was no point where I felt like a character needed to have an emotional exposition scene to just lay the table, right? The table is laid, and it's all background story for what's happening anyway, right? Which I think is smart. I think far too many horror movies spend way too much time dealing with backstory. Speaking of Evil Dead Rise, right? I liked Evil Dead Rise a lot. I have issues with the DJ kid being the one who gets the exposition responsibility because he has a record player.
Yeah.
Okay. I also, like, again, I don't want to spend too much time on Evil Dead Rise because it's a different thing, but the ability to cut your own records via a device that you could purchase at home didn't come to the market until like the 30s, and all of the records that were being recorded that get played in that film are supposedly from like 1917 or something.
And the dire situation that those priests found themselves in makes me wonder, where did they find the time?
Where did they set up the recording equipment, and how'd they make sure
where
that the mics were connected?
Where did they get the recording equipment?
Yeah, I don't know.
Those are some wealthy priests.
It's a problem when your franchise is established that listening to recordings of people reading ancient passages is part of the thing, and then you try to set it in a time period where that technology didn't
exist. Irony is, if you talk to kids, little kids, now tapes are cool again. So they could have just done tapes.
Yeah. Cassettes are back, baby. The cycles in which we live, like, I just don't understand. It's pretty messed up. Tapes suck, man.
Yeah.
They're terrible. They sound bad. They break.
You know, it seems awful. Really cool and old-timey until you're sticking your pinky finger into one little to wheel trying to wind thing. It back together.
Hoping that it doesn't crunch up in the thing the wrong way. Okay, so anyway, out of Evil Dead Rise. But there are moments in horror films that become obsessed with, they really just shove their heads up their own butts about their exposition, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, we've got to explain the demons come from Kandaria, you know, whatever. Like, just fucking stop it. Like, that's Bagul. That's not the problem. You've got a Bagul problem.
That movie's given us so much.
Dude, yeah, Vincent D'Onofrio's 5-minute Zoom call with the makers of the original Sinister have just... they've become legend. I don't think I told you I did watch Sinister 2. I'd never watched Sinister 2. I didn't have a reason to. Sinister is a great horror film. Apart from the Bagul problem, it's a wonderful horror film. Those little, you know, 8mm, 16mm, you know, horror films are all bangers. Very good. I watched Sinister 2. Didn't hate it. Totally unnecessary. Didn't need to exist. Very glad to see James Ransom. James Ransom is very good as Deputy So-and-So. Again,
and
that's still how he's credited. His name is never spoken, and he is still credited in the film as Deputy So and So. Which I did kind of love that. I was like, oh, that's
good.
But anyway, yes. So that exposition stuff isn't necessary here because the story is about the mother and the son. That's the story we're telling, and I think it's very smart for Cronin to just sort of like leave all that there. That's just all background. And I like a director that looks at an audience and says, you can figure this out, right? You understand this. You know what's happening here. I shouldn't have to tell you. And my gosh, is that rare these days. Holy cannolis, is that rare these days for a director to just look at his script, look at his film and say, you know, if the audience is paying attention and they're invested in the story, which if I'm doing my job as a director, they will be, I don't think I should have to explain this.
Yeah.
Right. And that's great. That's very refreshing. Probably not something that he'll ever have the opportunity to do again, unless he goes back to making his own stuff. Because again, that's not how Hollywood horror movies work. In Hollywood horror movies, everything has to be explained unless you're maybe Jordan Peele. But we'll see. But yeah, so it's all sort of subtly hinted that she was in this abusive relationship. She's escaped to the countryside and may even be in hiding from the dad. Like, we don't really know.
Yeah,
and we don't have
it
to.
It seems like they are. Like, that's a suggestion. But yeah, it doesn't tell you, which I like.
Yeah, it's not interested in it. So the crux of the film really begins with the discovery as the son gets angry. As you said, they get into a fight. He runs out into the woods and they discover, not terribly far from their home, a hole in the ground. What looks like a sinkhole, right? Not just a dug hole. This is a natural hole seemingly that has opened up, but it is massive. It is crater sized. And of course she tells her son, never go near this. This is so dangerous. And it's kind of just left there for 10 or 15 minutes or so. Like, they don't really come back to it. But then, and I'm trying to remember this, the exact specifics. It's late at night. She's awake. The son has had trouble sleeping and she goes to check on him for some reason and he's gone.
Yeah.
He's out of his bed. She checks the house. He's nowhere to be found. And then, I guess suspects that maybe he's gone outside. She runs outside, goes to the sinkhole, can't find him. And then when she comes back, she's talking to the police, which I liked that conversation too. The police, you know, most of the time in movies, you know, somebody calls and says, oh, I've got a missing person. Then the police are like, oh, tell us where. We'll be there immediately. You know, a very typical like police response. But for some reason, I think this is probably the more accurate response. Like, are you sure?
Did you
look? Are you sure he's not? Did you look? Did you look in the bathroom? Like,
maybe
did you
look
in the
again.
Basement? You know, like they're very like, yeah, you know, it's just a little kid. Yeah, he's still there. Just look around. He's hiding, you know,
yeah.
and I really appreciated that because it gives the mother a chance. We, you know, again, I can't really express how well the mother is played by Kerslake because she's been kind of completely flat in the film up until this point, like emotionless, right? Blunted almost. from an emotional standpoint. Like she's certainly experiencing emotions, but her responses have not been heightened in any way. And she kind of explodes in this scene and she's losing it. Like, no, you don't understand. He is gone. And so I really liked that subtle escalation, because another issue that I have with horror movies often is that you have characters playing it so big, so quickly, that you reach, there's no longer any crescendo in the story, right? There's no longer like an upswing. They just immediately go to the, they immediately turn the knob to 11, and then they are at 11 for the remainder of the picture. And that's, I get tired of that. I don't know about you. I don't know how you feel about it, but like, well, when you've got a character that goes to that emotional intensity, it's not real, you know?
It's not very realistic. It's not that anything has to be realistic, but it kind of takes me out of a movie when everything immediately ramps up. Like, where does it go? Where are we going to go from here with the tension?
Right. I mean, I still appreciate the slow build. I think there's a lot to be said for the slow build. I know it's not a typical taste, right? I mean, we were talking about Hereditary earlier a little bit before we started recording. And I'll admit I held off on watching that for a really long time. I don't love Ari Aster's stuff. It's not to say I don't recognize the skill involved. He's an extremely good director. His violence is so perfectly on point. It's disturbing. It's uncomfortable. It's somehow stoic at the same time. Like it's very, I think at this point you could show me, you know, a new Ari Aster film and leave all the credits off, and I would know immediately, oh, this is an Ari Aster film. Like, and that's saying something. Not every director has that kind of stamp. I haven't seen Beau Is Afraid. I've heard it's a train wreck. I'm still kind of curious to see it. I don't know if I can handle Joaquin Phoenix as all the characters. That seems a little strange.
That's maybe the first of his movies I'm not interested in seeing. And I think it might be that I'm not a big Joaquin Phoenix fan.
Yeah, not. I wouldn't put myself in that category either. I certainly don't hate him. I think he's done some good work. But yeah, anyway.
I loved him in Inherent Vice.
Oh, sure. Yes. Inherent Vice. Great. Yes.
Paul Thomas Anderson.
Give me some Paul Thomas Anderson. He can morph any actor into a triumph. But yeah, so, you know, Hereditary sort of has some similar notes. It has some similar things going on here. Aster is also very emotionally restrained. You know, his characters have these big highs and lows. Colette in Hereditary is a phenomenal. I mean,
I love
she should
her.
Have won all the awards for that movie.
I love that woman.
It would be I think Hereditary would be unwatchable without the Colette performance. Without her anchoring that, the sort of slow fracturing of her mind as those events unfold, that movie would be just a disaster without that. But so for Cronin here, we're getting very capable emotional handling of the characters. So the son has disappeared. She's freaking out on the phone, and then he reappears seemingly out of nowhere, and claims, "Yeah, I was just say he was in the bathroom or something." And from that point on, something is off. Right, his complaints about her food disappear. He brings her flowers in the morning to make her feel good.
And you kind of don't notice it at first.
Yeah, it all seems like very normal stuff, especially given that they've had these sort of semi-emotional rifts between them, right? It's almost like the kid's trying to make good, right? Like, oh, okay, I know I've been kind of a little shit. So here, let me be nice to you. But then it very rapidly shifts into something else.
And the big moment is when they encounter the creepy old woman who spots the boy and says, "That's not your son."
Right. And it sparks a pretty major confrontation. The husband comes out and he's trying to be apologetic and things. But, you know, it's obvious that this woman has seen something in the boy. And this is another thing about the film that I really liked is that yes, it's nebulous whether or not, you know, is this Capgras syndrome? Is it a mother sort of misreading this situation and just sort of not realizing that it is her son, but he's grown or changed? Like, the film sort of plays in that for about 20 minutes, right? Where she's asking other people, does he seem okay? You know, and she's spotting things and seeing things. But then the film puts a very definitive foot down and says, no, this is something that's happening. And I kind of appreciated that because I felt that they could potentially just let it go the whole movie. Like, is he himself and she's crazy? Or is he, you know, some monster and she's sane, but, you know, is seeing things that other people can't see? You know, they could have really played that out for way longer than they ended up doing. But I think that was a very smart choice, like a super good choice. Because, again, I guess I'm realizing that a horror movie, for me, there needs to be some kind of win condition, right? There needs to be some way for the character to beat this thing. And I understand that more ambiguous, more elevated, more nebulous, more, oh, it's just an unstoppable force that we can never kill or destroy. It's too big for any human being to deal with. I don't like those. Yeah. I'm not into that, right? I don't always want to see that. Yeah, I've got a taste for it. I'm okay with that in certain circumstances, but I don't think that works for most stories that are told in the horror genre.
Because these are movies.
Yeah,
we are supposed to be having a good time.
Ideally, yeah. Maybe that's the Ari Aster problem. Most of his movies are not a good time.
I admit, I can't always get down with those kinds of movies. Like, I love Hereditary and I loved Midsommar. I just thought those were great. But I don't know if I could take film after film after film like that. I mean, that's like the Lars von Trier problem, isn't it?
Totally.
And like, how much can I stand?
Aster stuff gives me such von Trier vibes, man.
Yeah.
Like, because he chooses to shoot things in that sort of Dogma 95 straightforward style, you know. Like,
yeah.
He's just very plaintive in that approach. I mean, it is a style and he is extremely stylistic, but the Dogma 95, like the cinema verite, the camera is truth, right? Like, Aster is very much in that realm for me. You know, the way that he shoots, you know, those scenes in Midsommar when the ritual is happening and they're leaping off the rocks and the camera just doesn't cut, like it's just showing him as they hit and everything. Like, that's very Lars von Trier, right? The camera will not look away. Like, there is no point. And there were even a couple of scenes in Hereditary, which, you know, again, he did before Midsommar, where the camera did look away for a thing. And I was like, oh, and I was surprised. I was like, why did it look away? Like, that's not the theme that he's established in his work. But I guess there are even some points that the modern censor board is like, come on, man. I don't know. It was kind of weird. Oh, I guess it was spoilers for Hereditary, I guess, when she cuts her head off.
Yeah.
And we cut away and we just hear it hit the floor, right? Like, we know that it's happened. And it's very good. I mean, it's a great shot. It's a great scene.
But I'm not like, always in the mood to see things like that.
Exactly. I mean, maybe you only get one severed head per movie from the MPAA before you get an NC-17. Maybe that's the deal. I don't know. We'll ask the Terrifier people. See if that's how it works. God, that movie's a piece of shit. Sorry. Side note. Terrifier sucks. Don't watch that garbage. Give that guy any more money. He's already going to make 17 more of those goddamn things. But anywho, this movie, I think, handles that very well. I think it says, it lets you exist in this, like, ooh, is she, isn't she, you know, back and forth kind of thing for a while. And then it says, like, nope, this is it. And then it moves. And I appreciated that immensely. Because she's out, you know, her suspicions continue to compound. She goes to the funeral of the old woman because she winds up dead. The old woman,
really,
who,
freaky way. Her head is buried underground.
Yeah.
That was very scary.
Yes. That's a terrible way to die, right? So that you suffocate, but only your head is buried, right? Again, hole in the ground. That's where we're at with this. And so she dies in this horrible way. It's assumed to be a suicide, which, okay.
How?
Sure. Yeah. Or I'd like to see a human being self-suffocate by burying their head in the ground. But it's deemed a suicide due to her past, you know, mental state. And she goes to the funeral and finds out, we do get a bit more exposition about her. Namely, that she had covered the house in mirrors. And according to the husband, she still checked him every day to make sure that he was him and that the mirrors helped her with that. So we get some other things, a great little performance by Cosmo. Again, he's just sort of a side character in this, but he's very good in the scenes that he's in. And so that gives her an idea to film the sun, right? Which, of course, is light passing through a mirror and then being recorded. And so she films him, and then I did kind of appreciate that we never actually see the results. She shows it to Cosmo, and he's like, nope, turn it off. Don't want to see it. But it's obvious that it's something, right? The camera picked up something. And so we get, you know, it's a little bit of that investigation, a little bit of that, like, oh, we're going to do some tests. We're going to see what's going on here. And you know, it very effective. Right. Just very effective, slow build of her sort of coming to a realization or a discovery.
Well,
and I guess it all culminates on the night of a talent show where the boy is singing as part of a choir, which very creepily shot. It's like all in slow motion. And it's one of the it kept reminding me of the birds. It's one of those weird little rounds that they're singing, you know. Hippelty hoppelty no, you know, like whatever. I don't even remember, but it's like a little, you know, Irish round that they're all singing.
It's a very old folk song that is actually really fun because it gets faster as you sing it and you add more layers to it. So it's a fun song, which of course it wasn't
not
so
how
fun.
She perceives it.
No,
she perceives it as absolute terror. Because in her mind, I guess, because there is this sub through that, you know, the son is new at the school and he's had all these conflicts with people, doesn't have any new friends. And then all of a sudden, the son makes all the friends, even with people that he had called out as being sort of bullies or people who had mistreated him. Now, all of a sudden, he's friends with everyone. And that's another sort of, is it a red flag? Like, is that bad or is that good? Like, you know, there's a lot of that. And again, just very capably handled. As escalation of evidence that something is amiss, apart from just her natural feeling as a mother that something is amiss. And she has there's like a dream sequence where she's feeding him food, and then it all kind of there's cool stuff, lots of cool stuff. We don't have to go into every bit of it. But the final point of escalation is. I guess she has. Does she have a dream of poisoning him, or putting, or does she give him like a, or does she actually give him like a sleeping drug?
She has been taking sedatives for diagnosed anxiety, and she uses them to drug him.
Right, that's right. And then she confronts him once the sedatives are in his system, believing that he would be more pliable or malleable, I guess, but he never really falls asleep. And then she tries to play their game. They have like a silly face game that they make where they count to three and then whoever makes the silliest face wins, which was seeded way earlier in the film. And so she tries to get the kid to play that game and he doesn't know what it is.
Yeah.
And that's like the final nail in the coffin, so to speak, that this is not in actuality her son, which again, the movie plants a very clear flag that this is not her kid. You know, she's not crazy. She is not suffering from Capgras syndrome. There is something wrong. And she also finds his G.I. Joe doll out by the sinkhole. Right. So that's how she kind of, his favorite toy. And he explains that it's in his room somewhere or something. And so she confronts him about the whole thing. And then she wakes up with her head buried in the ground. So it's trying to kill her in the same way. And then we move into ostensibly the most, I would say the most openly horrific section of the film. Like here things get pretty serious. in terms of horror. We've talked before. I don't like caves. Don't like caves.
Yeah.
Don't like underground shit. I got some video on YouTube of the other day that came up in the shorts, and it was just this dude who's crawling through a cave, and he had opened up his phone to say, like, you know, I was crawling this way because I believed that it was going to get wider, but I realize now that that was just a visual illusion of the cave top reflecting off the water because there was water in this cave.
Oh.
And he's like, you know, it's raining a lot today. This is probably going to get a lot more water in it. And I'm stuck. I can't move. I'm going to try and go back, but I'm not sure I can. And that was the end of the short. That's where it ended. And I was like, fuck you. And so I went on YouTube and I started hunting around and I eventually found the full video. And the guy, thankfully, thank Christ, he got out. But like, he was fucking stuck in a cave that was slowly filling with water because he had thought that it was going to widen up. And I was like, nope, no, bad idea. Don't do that.
Just, you know, anytime someone is in a cave, it gives me flashbacks to the fucking Ted's Caving page.
Yep.
And I don't like thinking about that.
Don't like thinking about
bad
Ted's
stuff
caver.
Happens in the earth. And
stay out of the earth.
Stay out of it.
No, but anyway, so I mean, obviously where this film is going from the title is she returns to the sinkhole, but instead of standing at the surface, she goes down and at the bottom finds yet an entrance to a cave. Believing, you know, hoping really that her son is inside. She trapped the other one in the basement, which I think is great. And he
just goes berserk.
Berserk.
And it's terrifying.
It's bad, man. Like, again, kids can be terrifying. And I like that this film sort of leans into that a little bit. And so she goes down and begins crawling through this tiny, tiny little cave. Dirt cave, really. It's not even a cave. It's just dirt. And then she finds things buried in the dirt, right? Covered in some kind of vine or webbing. Faceless things. And again, not an expensive practical effect. Like they definitely spend some money on these things. They look good.
But they also don't focus on them too long. This doesn't go on and on.
Yes, right. They're not lingering on this stuff.
It did look bad. Even if there was some bad effects here, that's not what this scene is about. It's not what the movie is about, which I think is great.
Yes, super good choices being made all throughout this sequence.
Yeah. I really like that this part did not last a long time. I don't know why that stuck with me, but sometimes I feel like the final showdown in a movie, just it's too long. It's too much. And this wasn't. It happens pretty quickly.
Yeah, all of this. I mean, again, you know, we've talked about this extensively. That we appreciate the films of the shorter variety. Yeah. And this one is a swift 90 minutes. Like it is exactly 90 minutes. So the third act is not belabored. It does not go on longer than it should. It doesn't turn into the descent or anything like that. Which, you know, thank the maker that it did not. But it is this woman fighting for her life underground against some faceless thing. She, of course, eventually finds her son, who is also buried in the ground. She finds other corpses as well. You know, dead.
Well, she finds the corpse of the son who died, the old woman's son.
James, yeah.
Because his tooth is missing.
Right, and they made special mention of that earlier in the film. So, you know, we get a lot of, I like films that give us that confirmation, right? Like, okay, we know now that this is actually a thing. These things exist. And so she obtains her son, sort of heaves him out of there, is crawling back through the cave. One of these things wakes up and is chasing her. And, you know, there's a wonderful confrontation in the cave between her and the creature. She turns around to look at it and it's her, right? It is turned into her. And then
it touches her.
It touches her, right? And presumably she kills herself, which I think is an interesting metaphor here. You know, there's lots in classical literature about the doppelganger, right? The mirror image of you and what that might mean, right? We've seen, you know, Denis Villeneuve approach that concept with the great Jake Gyllenhaal film Enemy, and sort of the nature of the doppelganger, the self that is not yourself kind of thing. And this movie is not dwelling on that at all. But this is a movie about a woman sort of reclaiming her life, right? Like, thematically, that is sort of, I would say, not even an undertone of this. Like, it's really the major thrust of it, is that she has had her life taken from her. We get that insinuation about, you know, she had plans to go to college, to, you know, have a career and all of that. She kind of lost that because of the family situation. You know, and again, I think a lot about the wallpapering of the stairway, right? The destruction and rebirth of a thing into something that is better than it was before. And she's kind of laboring on that. And I feel like it's a thematic element that gets played out here with her leaving this other thing behind, right? She literally overcomes herself.
She overcomes, you know, the cave that's full of the horrible, hideous monsters. And the thing that follows her out is actually her. And she takes it out.
Yeah. Like she kills herself.
It's satisfying.
Yeah.
The movie doesn't go out of its way to like point that out to us either. Whereas like, did you see that that was like a metaphor?
Right. She doesn't sit down with a therapist later in the film and be like, well, I killed myself. What does that mean, doctor? And he says, well, I think it means that you've leveled up.
But you finally healed.
Achieved, you know? Yeah. Like that doesn't happen here, but it's one of the things that I like about Cronin, and again, I think the reason we've talked about Ari Aster and some of these other guys, is that these are directors that fundamentally understand visual symbolism. They fully understand pure visual storytelling without the need for dialogue. Which again, I don't want to make it seem like that's special or totally unique, but there are certainly directors that do that better than others, right? There are directors who have a script and they shoot the script. And then there are directors who have a script and shoot a film, right? Like, and those are different, in my opinion. Like, Steven Spielberg shoots a film from a script, and this is going to sound derogatory, it's not intended to be, but then you have guys like the Russo brothers, right? The Marvel guys. The Russo brothers shoot a script. Right. They have dialogue, they have scenes, they have action, and they shoot those things. If they stop to get a shot with the B team of a character reaching for something or pointing at something, great. But that's about it. Right. And that's fine. That's a very viable style of filmmaking. And that's a very fundamental style of filmmaking. But then there are directors that, you know, I guess we'll get highfalutin for a second. There are directors who approach film like poetry, right? Where
it rhymes.
Exactly. The George Lucases of film.
He was right.
Really.
He was right.
But they understand that there's much that can be done with the camera itself and with production design and with intentionality behind those things. And I think Cronin has that. And I think that he brought a lot of that to Evil Dead Rise. I think that's why Evil Dead Rise is ultimately a success. Even if I was not like terrifically engaged by it, I didn't leave it saying like that was a disaster. Right. Like it wasn't at all. Like it's a very good film. Maybe not what I was looking for out of an Evil Dead sequel or remake or prequel or prequel make or whatever. I don't know. But beautifully done, and that the evidence of his skill in that is here in this quiet little Irish film. So she, as you said, she crawls her way out of the hole. She deals with the doppelganger of herself. That's not shown to us what happens. All we see is the hand on her leg, and then she turns the camera and looks. And so I guess there is even an insinuation here. Maybe the mom doesn't make it out alive. Although I don't really think we're supposed to believe that. Maybe
I think
that's
it faked us up. But that's not what happens.
Yeah, I think so. And then she she returns to the house. They collect some things, gets in the car, and then she burns the house down with the thing in the basement. Which I kind of liked that. I was kind of wondering, is like, okay, so she's going to go back in the basement and murder this thing? Is she going to kill the doppelganger of her kid?
Nope.
We're just going to burn the house down and run away.
I loved it because about 40 seconds before she sets the house on fire, I was like, she needs to burn that house down.
Yep.
And then she did. And I was like, the movie gave me what I wanted.
it knows me.
I love it when that happens.
Yeah, it was super cool. Really, really a satisfying ending to that. That both and also caps like this life, because she's been rebuilding this house, she's been remaking it, and now it's like, no, we're gone. Like, this is not my life. And I kind of liked that. There's some complexity to those ideas. And then we pick up a nebulous amount of time later, a few months, I guess, and they're back in the city, right? And they've got an apartment now. She goes to pick the son up from school and kind of a mirror.
She's in school herself.
She has returned to school. Exactly. Right. So she's pursuing an education, a career, a life of her own. She's got friends. She goes out and meets people, goes to pick the son up from school in kind of a mirror of the opening of the film. But she has a bike for him now. Right. He's growing and she's got this bike. And, you know, everything seems great. Right. All is well. And then the son stays outside to ride the bike in the courtyard of their apartment. And she goes up, she gets the camera out. She's looking at him through the window. She's taking pictures, right? Because one of the things that James Cosmo had said was that for the rest of his wife's life,
she checked him every day in the mirror because the mirror doesn't lie. The
mirror doesn't lie. And so she's taking pictures and looking at the pictures. And then the camera pulls back and pans back, and their entire apartment is covered in mirrors everywhere.
It's great.
Wonderful ending. A little bit unsettling, right? A little bit unsettling, like, oh my God, you know. But really, it gives us confirmation, right? This is the mom, right? She's not the doppelganger. And because of this experience, she will, for the rest of her life, remain vigilant that it'll never happen again.
Yeah.
And I liked that. I thought that was great because there were some screenwriting tips that, I can't remember who shared them the other day. And they were old. Like they're from like a handwritten little pamphlet that this guy used to give his writing students. And one of the ones that really struck me was a character who is dramatically interesting is intelligent enough to think ahead. Right. And I read that and I was like, my God, how many main characters in films are so dumb that they can't Craig Mazin calls it the audience is ahead of the movie. Right. Like the audience already knows where this is going. And if your characters don't, then you're going to lose your audience because your characters are catching up with the people who are watching the film. And that was a little bit of my issue with Hereditary, is that I got ahead of that movie pretty quick. And then it was mostly just seeing how things played out. That's what I was waiting for. But it was like, oh, this is fucking Rosemary's Baby. That's what this is. This is Rosemary's Baby for the modern era, right? Like that's what we've done here. And it's very good at being that. But I knew that 20 minutes in.
Yeah, it took a long time for the movie to get there.
And that's fine because like most of the dramatic tension in that film for the characters comes with the slow realization of what they're involved in, right? And that, but I knew. And so I was like, okay, yeah, okay, sure, yes. Oh, her mom made floor mats just like that, huh? Okay, cool. Well, I'm sure they don't know each other. How could they? You know, that kind of stuff. But it is an interesting thing. But one of the things I like about this is that this mom character, because she's positioned as the character who has seen what's really happening, she's dramatically interesting enough and intelligent enough to like make plans. Oh, I'm going to make a decision. Oh, I see where this is going. I've got to stop this now. And that's just such an engaging thing. And it's so rare in horror films. Because horror films almost fundamentally depend upon main characters who have no fucking clue what they're doing. And gosh, that's just frustrating sometimes. Yeah. You know, it's frustrating to watch characters do that. I will say in Evil Dead Rise, the characters who live, let me put it that way, they do seem to get there. Like, they don't start there, but then they get there over the course of the film and make some plans and have goals, you know, other than just escape or survive. And so I think that Cronin's instincts are pretty good. And I think it also reveals to me, again, we kind of had been talking about, like, oh, this movie reminds me about, I like this about horror films. But I just really like horror films that are capable of having smart characters. And I'll point to one that I know you love. We've mentioned on this podcast many times. But there's a moment in Event Horizon when Lawrence Fishburne is standing in a hallway and he's like, we are getting the fuck out of here.
He says, fuck this ship.
Fuck this ship. We are done.
And it was so perfect because it was the exact moment the audience said, man, fuck this movie.
Why are
this
you
is
still
fuck,
here?
Fuck. Get out of
out
here.
Of here.
And then like, they do. And then the movie just becomes about getting out of there. And it's great.
It's great. It's so satisfying when the characters in the audience come to the same conclusion on the next course of action at the same time. And it's perfect. And that's one of the reasons why Event Horizon, I don't care what you want to say about Paul W.S. Anderson. Yes, he's been riding on the billion-dollar laurels of his beautiful wife and the Resident Evil franchise for years. But Event Horizon is a goddamn masterpiece.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. And, yeah. And I think in many ways, it was such a significant moment in my development as a fan of horror that in some ways it's kind of spoiled me because it's like it's such a good example of horror being done. I'm not going to say it's perfect. It's not a perfect film. Like, there are goofy things about it, of course. But there are so many things that work in that movie and work brilliantly that it sort of spoils, right? Of like, oh, well, why can't the characters in this movie not be morons?
I measure, you know, every sci-fi horror movie against Event Horizon.
Totally.
Unfairly.
Totally. Yeah, it's not
like,
fair.
Well, it's not going to be as good as Event Horizon, but
it's not fair.
We'll see.
It's just such a banger script, man. It's such a good script. I interacted with the author of that on Twitter. And because he was like, I got a few minutes, asked me a question. And I the question I asked was like, how does it feel to be the guy who wrote the explanation of how wormholes work that has now been copied by like dozens of other films? Like, they just use your explanation, the folding the paper, the pushing the pencil through. Like, that's just the default explanation now. And he's like, I don't really think I came up with that. I'm sure that I came across it in a paper or something somewhere. He's like, so I hate to take credit for that. And I was like, no, dude, like, like Interstellar just stole that scene from you. Like, they straight up just used it.
Every script writer saw that and was just like, oh, that's it.
That's it. You're done.
We don't have to
say anything else.
We don't have to do that scene anymore. That's already been done.
All right. We need to explain wormholes to Event Horizon, you know? Yeah, it's just, it was so funny. And he was so humble about it. I was like, dude, no, like, you're incredible. Don't put yourself down. This is like literally one of the most foundational scientific concepts explained in film that's been copied over and over and over again. I was left thinking about that quote because I had seen it in relatively close proximity to watching this. And I was like, hey, it's a character who's got agency, right? She's not passive and reactive, which is how most characters in horror films are, right? A thing happens and then they do something. She's doing
and,
things.
And it's not know? Happily ever after. You know, a lot
no.
of horror movies
yeah.
where
no.
there are a win condition, as you put it, they end up going a little bit too far in the happy-go-lucky part when they do win. And then everything
is fine. And then you got a
Bagul
problem.
You know? Yeah. And this movie doesn't have the slam cut at the end where you see the face of the monster, it's returned.
Right.
Instead,
kid,
it's just
we cut to
no.
the kid breaking out of the
yeah,
burning
like
basement.
It doesn't do anything stupid like that. It
no,
just
no.
leaves you with this kind of niggling, haunting, like, oh, that really changed then, didn't it?
Yeah, like the scars of this event will be with her forever, even though she has seemingly begun the process of moving on, right? So she has both psychologically moved on, but she has also been left with significant scars from this event.
It's a metaphor.
Which is a metaphor for her relationship, right? Because we were shown about halfway through the movie that she has this wicked scar on her forehead, right? Like she was, which again supports the Capgras syndrome potentiality, but like she was severely beaten at one point in her relationship to the point that it may have even fractured her skull.
And it seems like that's the injury that caused her to finally leave her relationship because it's still relatively fresh.
Right. Like there is a scene when she starts, you know, believing that the sun is an issue. That's where she gets the medication from. She has a doctor come by and do an assessment, and he notes it and is like, you know, can you tell me about that? Got an explanation for that? And there's, you know, again, subtle and careful use of exposition, right? Exposition comes naturally. It comes when the characters are engaged in other activities, which again is sort of like classic writing advice. Like, don't deliver exposition unless your characters are doing something. They should never just be sitting in a room talking about exposition concepts, right? Like, they need to be doing shit. And so, like, the exposition here comes as part of this medical examination that was, you know, happened because of some other reason. So it's just very cool. Like, so many smart choices, so many choices made correctly. And, you know, as we know, filmmaking really is just making a series of incredibly complicated and difficult choices. And the quality of your film is often determined by which choices you choose to make.
Yeah.
Right? And Cronin, based on this, and honestly, based on Evil Dead Rise, which again, I know I sound like I've bagged on in this episode, like I didn't think was very good. Not the case. Cronin has in these two films, and these are his only two films, like he made a couple of short movies. He did have a short in that, was it Minutes to Midnight? I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen Minutes to Midnight, so maybe I have seen it. I didn't remember it, but he did do one of those anthology sequences for that. It's Ghost Train, I think is what his segment was called. But that was back in like 2013. That was years ago. So these are really his only two sort of major projects. So I'm very interested in what he does next. I kind of hope he goes back to a smaller, sort of more independently financed project, maybe another script that he works on. I would be pretty happy about that. Although he did write Evil Dead Rise as well. Like he was both director and writer, which, you know, given the long development history of that film, like Evil Dead Rise had been in various stages of production, or a new Evil Dead film, I should say. And Evil Dead Rise itself, maybe not. But it's pretty shocking that he got solo writing credit on that. You know, not even a Raimi brother got attached to the writing of that thing. So, Evil Dead Rise, very solid. You know, not necessarily what I was hoping for out of an Evil Dead film, but very solid. So I'm super excited to see what dude does next. I think he's poised to be, I don't want to call him mainstream horror director, but like, I guess a more mainstream horror director than a guy like Ari Aster or something like that.
His movies seem like they'll be more watchable.
Yeah. I mean, Evil Dead Rise made like $150 million on a $15 million budget. Like, that's money that will motivate Sam Raimi to make more of them, I think. You know, like that's enough to get Raimi excited about making more Evil Dead movies.
And like I said, even if I'm not like 100% on this as an Evil Dead movie, I enjoyed the movie. And if it gives Lee Cronin the opportunity to make more movies just based on the strength of this movie, hell yeah.
Sure.
Do it.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
And maybe if they get past the, okay, we've quote unquote relaunched the franchise, like people care about it now. We know that they're going to come to the theaters to watch it. Now we can push into more of that stuff, right? Now we can sort of have that. And really, the lead actress in Evil Dead Rise, Lily Sullivan, I never really saw the lead of Evil Dead 2013 being like the new recurring lead character for a franchise, right? I just, I never read her that way. By the end of it, she's set up to be that. Like, she's set up to be the new Ash, literally. But I never really saw her as being capable or maybe just right for being in that position. And that's just me. And it's nothing about the actress. It was more like the character that they built over the course of that film. I didn't see being like the person that you would follow in all these new dead-eyed adventures, whatever they might be.
I did not connect with that movie at all. Yeah. I just didn't. And to the point where other than a bunch of moments where I just felt physically uncomfortable, like a little bit sick.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember much about it. Basically, it was called Evil Dead. I felt gross.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a forgettable film. There's certainly like very memorable moments in 2013. But like, I never really engaged with any of the characters. You know, I never really cared. You know, I felt bad for them. I was like, oh shit, that sucks. Like, that's a terrible way to die. They never engaged me. But Lily in this one, you know, this sort of like roadie, you know, sort of like badass music chick, it's very reductive. I apologize. But she seems a character like, okay, so being a roadie means like you're good at.
She was like a guitar tech.
Yeah, you know, like
that was her specialty. Yeah, was she? Well, but, I mean, like, to be honest, I don't really know what all those. I don't know what those things entail.
Right, right.
So
you know, but it did justify later. She has to work with some of the musical equipment and stuff. So I get it. It's justified. But I could see her being a character that moves forward. But I really don't know if that's what we're going to get. I don't know if they're trying to establish her as like the new lead of a film. Like that's not what this felt like. So maybe there's something else coming down the pike, or maybe they're just going to do little independent standalone Evil Dead stories, which is also fine. So Cronin is an exciting director. I definitely recommend Hole in the Ground. Great film. I also recommend Evil Dead Rise, but you need to know what you're getting into with Evil Dead Rise. It's violent, super gory. You know,
there's a lot of black vomit.
I think I was discording you while I was watching Evil Dead Rise, and I was like, this really reminds me of Drag Me to Hell, because there's just people getting vomited on constantly.
So much puke
is a Sam Raimi thing. Like Raimi,
maybe that's how Cronin got the script greenlit, and he's like, look how much black vomit
black vomit.
Don't you love that?
This character's getting covered in it. This one's. He's drinking it, you know, like just so much black
vomit. These are some kids getting covered in black vomit.
Yeah, we've never seen that before. But it had that sort of like Drag Me to Hell quality to it. A little bit for me. I still recommend it. Like it's a good horror flick, and definitely one of the better ones of the last couple of years in my mind. I think it was very good. I liked the new setting and I liked how Cronin shot and handled those interiors. Extremely well done. He's definitely a fan of The Shining though, because there's the wallpaper in this one and then there's just a straight up blood elevator in Evil Dead Rise.
Which, hey, you know, I'm a fan too.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a great movie.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to call back to the best, it's nothing wrong with that, I guess. You know, I don't really know where to cap this at, but needless to say, I think we can both heavily recommend Hole in the Ground. Even if you're not a huge horror fan, like Hole in the Ground is just an engaging family drama that does have this sort of like frightening element to it that I think works phenomenally well. And Cronin is now, just based on these two projects, I mean, he's a director to watch. Like, he will be on the list. Oh, this is Lee Cronin's new shit? Okay, I got to be in there. I got to check this out. You know, I find it funny that most of my like favorite horror directors are coming from these very disparate places. Like, I guess that's just how horror works, is that you can kind of come at it with these interesting perspectives from anywhere. You know, and I guess I say that to say that, you know, we're not seeing a lot of people coming out of the University of California film program making these horror movies, right? Like, they're coming from these really...
Nobody can afford it.
I guess not. Yeah, I guess that's really what it is. it's just interesting to me. And Cronin is certainly one of those guys that has quickly risen to my like, huh, cool. Yeah, we gotta keep an eye on this dude. I think directors and writers who are this careful and this sort of well considered in their approach are pretty hard to come by, and they're definitely hard to come by in the horror genre. So the fact that Lee Cronin is capable of both those things, and seemingly of, because even my issues with Evil Dead Rise, the structure of the story is very good, the character work is very good, and the overall sort of like the, and Evil Dead Rise even has like thematic content. It's very much a movie about motherhood, right? As in many ways as this one is, it's about what does it mean to be a mother, what does it mean to protect, what does it mean to not protect, what does it mean to fail. And I gotta admit, man, I like a horror movie that's like, hey, can't we have just some ideas? Can we have some ideas in here? Like just a couple that we can think about? Isn't that kind of interesting? And there's just so many horror films that just don't have that. And those are fun too in their own way, I guess. You know, sometimes it's nice. Hey, I watch Alien versus Predator for fun sometimes. Sure. Yeah. Why not? You know, it's garbage, but I like it. You know, so I don't know, but I definitely was very high on Hole in the Ground. I think this is a great film. Wonderful surprise. Huge recommend for me, basically.
Same. Yeah. This is one of those movies that, you know, similar to a lot of the other movies that we've discussed, maybe not movies like Sinister, but certainly like The Babadook. You watch it, and you think, wow, I could watch 10 more like that. But that's what makes this movie special. There probably won't be 10 more like this.
Yeah, like these are pretty rare in the horror space these days. At least ones that sort of achieve, they get big enough to know them, right? Like to actually be aware of
them.
Like I'm sure they're out there. But, you know, I don't have an active Shutter account, so I can't just like scroll through and be like, show me something that's really good. But
I've honestly thought about it. I thought, you know, if I'm ever gonna have a streaming service, right now I have none.
Good for you.
If I ever do, it'd probably be something like Shutter, just because that's mostly what I watch. Yeah, I watch a lot of horror movies. But yeah, right now, I don't know. I'm just trying not to give in to streaming. Max.
Yeah. I mean, I'll admit Max is probably the one that I would have the hardest time giving up at the moment. Another recommendation, listener and you, dear sister, we do have Apple TV Plus, which again, their problem is they don't have much. But what they do have, pretty much all of it's amazing. Like, I don't know who's curating their content, but they're being very good about it at the moment. And they just launched the adaptation of Hugh Howey's Silo series, the Wool series.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that.
With Rebecca Ferguson in the lead.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
She's like, always amazing.
Silo is very rapidly climbing to the top of my personal list of like best sci-fi shows. Like it's really good. The third episode, they really get into sort of the systems that power the silo, because that's kind of where Rebecca Ferguson's character comes from, is from down in like the maintenance regions of the silo, and she's trying to repair a problem before she goes up, so to speak, to take on this new job that she's been given. And dude, it was great. The series is apparently, a bunch of it's directed by Morten Tildum, the guy that did Imitation Game with Benedict Cumber Snatchy Batchy, which was which was, you know, that adaptation or it was Alan Turing's life. It was a good flick. Directed super well. I don't know, man. Really into it. Like, series is great. Definitely nice. Worth trying to track down. It's phenomenally good. I only really read the first two Wool short stories when they came out. The first one was a huge success. Like, it exploded. People lost their minds over that short story. And then, you know, he continued the series, introduced new characters and stuff. And I only read a few of those. And now it's all been collected into a whole thing. It's like seven different stories all woven together or whatever. The adaptation is a banger. Like, it's really good, beautifully shot, really high production values. It kind of makes me, I know they're making a Fallout show right now, which I am sure is going to be trash. Like, there is no universe in which a Fallout show is good. Not in modern America, because that whole, the whole series is about lampooning the idiocy of capitalism. Like, that's the whole point. And there's no corporation in existence that would fund a show that just so deliciously mocks their entire existence. I mean, the whole premise of Fallout is that people had to buy space at a shelter to keep them from dying in nuclear war. Like, oh my God. You know, you just buy it like, you know, it's like insurance. Yeah, whatever. Anyway. But this feels like a Fallout show. It feels like people living in a Fallout bunker. And that's awesome. Like, it's just so cool. It's really, really well done. Nice. Yeah. So I would say check that out if you can, at some point. There are ways. we know the ways.
I have my
to
ways.
Get those things. But yeah, so Silo is really good. But to wrap it up, I think we've covered the basics of Hole in the Ground. It's a solid, very well made, very well shot, very well acted, you know, little horror film slash, you know, family in crisis, and excellently done. Huge Babadook vibes, in the best way, right? Like, just all the things that you might have loved about the Babadook, this movie's hitting on a lot of those same ideas and executing very well. I did appreciate that Cronin, and I guess you see this a little bit in Evil Dead Rise too. You know, I'm not going to say I have issues with male directors and writers writing mothers, right? Like, I that would be ridiculous, because of course you can, but I do think that that's hard to do, because that's, I mean, fundamentally speaking, that's just not necessarily a role in society that, you know, a young male is going to be able to fully contemplate, I guess. But I think Cronin does well with that here. And he does in Evil Dead Rise as well. Like, those themes and ideas are something that he's dwelled on and thought about and gotten good feedback from people on, I would assume.
I agree. Yeah,
just it's handled well, you know, really, really sort of fantastic little thing. So again, streaming on Max, relatively easy to get on there if you have a subscription. Otherwise, might be a little bit difficult to track down, given that it's released in the United States. I don't think it has.
Oh, it's out there.
It's out there. I don't think it's had a physical release. I don't think you can go buy this on a disc or anything like that. If you're still a person that does that kind of thing, I don't know. I mean, I like discs sometimes, maybe.
I own two Blu-rays. That's it.
That's all you need. That's it. But yeah, so let's wrap up. So if someone wants to get hold of you and tell you about their Hole in the Ground, where can they do that?
I am on Twitter at Baskinator, posting about holes in the ground, in walls.
Yeah, I don't limit myself to just holes in the ground. I'm
that makes it sound like I'm running a really unsavory Twitter, which I am.
I'm just pro hole myself. I'm always on the side of holes. Big fan of holes. Like, I grew up with holes. I feel like I know a lot about holes.
I will defend a hole if I must.
Most of my best friends are holes. Let's be honest. But you can get a hold of me at T Baskin on Twitter. I am not on there much right now. Twitter has continued its rapid decline into idiocy and insanity. Every single thread is dominated by nothing but idiot blue checks. Goodness. But you can still get a hold of me there if you need to. I check it periodically. So T Baskin, you can get us together at F Peace Theater on Twitter, which I am on there quite a bit too, looking at that account. And you can get us at failurepeace@gmail.com if that's your game. I am still in the queue for a Blue Sky account. Not sure if I'm going to use that or not. If that comes through, I don't know. Like, The social media wars of the late 20s will be recorded and go down in history as some of the worst in humanity's history, I think.
But we should not replace Twitter. We should only let Twitter burn.
Yeah. And mission accomplished. It's happening before our eyes. Yep. Maybe when that new CEO comes in, that lady from that one place, maybe it'll all get
the
better.
The one lady.
That one lady that everybody's really upset about. Yeah, Mrs. Twitter. Wife of Mr. Peanut. But no.
A lot better than Mr. Twitter. That didn't go well.
Oh, geez. Oh, man. To watch a guy who was sort of universally hailed as a genius slowly and quietly prove to everyone that the opposite is, in fact, true. Man, you just don't get to see that very often.
I don't get to do this very often because I'm not cool, but I always thought he was an obnoxious turd. And I thought people were taking the piss when they were like, he's so cool. I didn't know they were serious.
Yeah, I remember all that shit about him buying the Tesla Museum and stuff. And ugh, that's gross. Anyway, but yeah, so Elon Musk sucks. Twitter's a hellscape. Go on there at your own peril. But if you want to find us. Yeah, come find us. We'll have a good time. We'll be all right. It'll be good. But all right. Well, thanks for listening. We appreciate your time and attention as always. And we hope if you get a chance to watch Hole in the Ground after our discussion or before it, that you enjoyed it as much as we did. And we hope you come back. Next time, we'll discuss another film that might have been overlooked or not paid attention to, or maybe didn't make as much money as it should have. Because not every movie can be a masterpiece, but it might just be a failure piece. And so, we'll see you then.
Bye-bye.